want to give a special welcome and shout out to Mount Horeb High School students who are here. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming, and you may be seated. Students are here with a program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. This is a national award-winning program. We invite students from public high schools, public middle schools, private schools, and homeschool students to come and hear an oral argument. We send them materials about the case. They may do some extracurricular activities about the case and come and listen to an oral argument and then meet with a justice assigned to these students at lunchtime to discuss the procedures of taking, deciding a case, and then issuing an opinion. The discussion will not involve the substantive issues of the case. We've met you. I would like now to introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Sitting next to him is Justice Patience Robinsack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Brooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And Justice Bradley is the judge assigned today to meet with you after this case to discuss the procedures of the court. To Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Prosser. And to the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I will call our second case today, State v. Joel M. Hurley, 2013 AP 558 CR. Representing the state of Wisconsin is Assistant Attorney General Jacob J. Whitworth. He will argue for 25 minutes if he wishes. We will then hear from Craig S. Powell, who has 30 minutes, who is arguing on behalf of the defendant, Joel M. Hurley, and then Mr. Whitwer will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Jake Whitwer, representing the state of Wisconsin in this matter. There are three issues presented here today in this case. The first is the notice issue. Regarding whether Hurley was provided adequate notice to prepare a defense. The second is whether the circuit court erroneously exercised discretion in admitting other acts evidence. And the third has to do with whether the court erred in ordering a new trial for the prosecutor's closing argument remarks. To take full advantage of the fact that the Hampton Hurley case.
Now, did the Court of Appeals order a new trial based on the third issue?
Court of Appeals did not know. The circuit court ordered a new trial based on the third issue, and the Court of Appeals did not address the third issue. To take full advantage of these cases being argued back-to-back, the Kempen and Hurley case, with the court's permission, I would like to address the first issue for the first portion of my argument. There are two significant differences conceptually between these two cases. The first has to do with the fact that the Hurley case arises post-conviction after a trial has already occurred. And in this case, with the benefit of a full trial record, it's easy to assess the defenses that were actually available to Mr. Hurley. The defense available to him under these circumstances, he lived with and had ongoing access to the victim during the offense period that was well established at trial. And the defense available was a credibility defense, which he vigorously pursued at trial, taking full advantage of the fact that the victim had difficulty recalling specific details of assaults. Even if a far narrower charging period had been alleged in this case, even as short as a few months, it would not have changed his defense. Post-conviction, it should be very difficult for a defendant to prevail on a claim that a charge violated his right to prepare a defense without showing how a narrower period would have actually allowed him to present a different defense than the one that he presented at trial. To look at it under the lens of plain error, the error in such a case is not so fundamental to require a new trial where the defendant cannot show that his defense would have been any different.
Well, if you go to trial on this broad time period, then showing alibi becomes almost impossible unless the guy is in the military or in North Dakota fracking oil, you know, for a long time. I don't see that argument. I just have trouble with it.
I think the defenses are always dictated by the circumstances of the case. And so here, because the defendant lived with and had continuing access to the victim, and the testimony at trial established that he was away for no more than a week at a time occasionally, he did not have a viable alibi defense. The only defense available to him and the only defense available in most of these situations where the accused is a family member living with the victim is that is a credibility defense, that it didn't happen. And no showing has been made here, even post-conviction now, with the benefit of a full trial at which he was given an opportunity to present a defense, how that defense was in some way insufficient, how he was denied his opportunity to present a different one.
Is there a different burden on the defendant pre-trial and post-conviction? Because I hear that. I hear that from you. I hear that the burden and the post-conviction is on the defendant to show prejudice.
Well, it certainly arises in the case of plain error. And so it's the obligation of the defendant to show that some error so fundamental has occurred that he is entitled to a new trial.
At the beginning of a case, at the outset, where the sufficiency, where the complaint is being challenged for whatever basis, that the defendant has the burden at that stage to show prejudice or lack of prejudice.
I think the movement seeking to dismiss a criminal charge always has some obligation to demonstrate facts supporting the charge.
That's right. That's not my question, however, right? Because your opposing counsel to the state on the case before says once, essentially, I'm paraphrasing, once the showing has been made that there is a deficient notice, then it's a really kind of a four corners of the complaint kind of analysis that we sometimes see in civil law, right? You look at the sufficiency, you're tied to the four corners, and there's no requirement to show prejudice or not prejudice. Either there's a sufficiency or an insufficiency. What's your position with regard to the need of the defendant to show prejudice at that stage, early stage of the proceeding?
I believe that the defendant does need to show prejudice at that stage of the proceeding, yes.
Okay. And why? What authority do you have for that deeply
held
belief?
Why? Well, let's look at what's actually being alleged. What's being alleged is that the defendant lacks notice to satisfy his due process right to prepare a defense. The question then arises, what is that defense under the circumstances of the case? And if the defendant, as in this case, is a parent who lives with the victim and is not gone for significant periods of time, then he lacks the opportunity to present any defense other than the one that was actually presented in this case at trial, a credibility defense.
You know,
and how would he use a narrower defense period to actually fashion a defense?
I understand your argument in terms of your case and in the confines of the analysis that we apply post-conviction. I understand that. But I think to myself, the four-corner rule. Why is the four-corner rule? What do you think that means? It means don't go beyond the four corners. Is there enough there or isn't there enough there? If that's good enough for civil law, where people's liberties are not at stake. Their money is, but not their liberties. Why isn't it good enough for criminal law where liberty is at stake?
Because there are other significant interests involved here, those of the victims. And what a person who is accused of serially molesting someone in their own household should not be in an advantaged position with regards to whether...
Hold it. Do you think I'm going to say, oh, yes, someone who is serially raping a 3-year-old should be advantaged? No, I'm not going to say that, and no one on this court should say this. My question is a legal question. My question is, at the beginning of a criminal proceeding, at the very outset, when you're testing the sufficiency of a complaint, I understand it's your argument that you go beyond the four corners and that the defendant has to show prejudice. And all I want to know is, what's your authority for that? Can you cite anything for that to support that premise?
Well, authority from other jurisdictions, certainly. That's the way that a majority of the states approach this issue, is that they look to the availability of other defenses when assessing a notice challenge to a complaint, that's pre-trial or post-conviction. And the reason that they do that, I think, is it's an unsatisfying claim that you were denied the right to prepare a defense when, in fact, your defense would not have been any different. Then if you can't take advantage of a more narrow charging period, then your defense would not have been any different. Why should we allow the criminal complaint to be dismissed in those circumstances?
Do you think that if the defense argument prevails in this case, that we're essentially finding that 948.025 sub 2 is unconstitutional?
I think there's a danger of that, yes. The second part of my argument here about what's different about this case is that it arises under 948.025.
I see these cases as very closely aligned and very similar issues presented. Maybe you do, maybe you don't, but to me they are. And that's why I asked counsel in the last case whether her argument was being narrowly tethered to those allegations in that complaint, which was not repeated acts of sexual assault. And I did specifically ask her about sub 2, where a jury just has to find there are at least 3 violations. They don't have to agree on which specific acts constitute the requisite number. That's in the statute. It's been there for some time. They don't have to have unanimity on that. And so how would you ever provide the requisite notice when you've got this kind of charge, and why would you have different notice for this charge versus another sexual assault? They're both important charges.
Right. No, I do think, and to dovetail in my argument in my brief about how the repeated nature of the offenses needs to be a consideration that's taken into account, I think also that the statute that authorizes charging repeated child sexual assault needs to be taken into account. The purposes of that statute should be taken into account in the notice analysis. While the legislature certainly can't legislate away due process, I think the courts need to take into account the purposes of the statute, which are explained in the Nomenson decision. The purpose was to facilitate, and this is from the legislative history of 948.025, was to facilitate the prosecution of repeated child sexual offenders, understanding that children have difficulty recalling the specifics of time and place, particularly in these repeat cases.
Counsel, I'd like to discuss with you something you said earlier in regard to, in cases where the alleged victim and the accused live together, that a shorter time period for the charging period would not be a benefit, in the absence of any kind of extended stay away, such as the hypothetical we've been using is the military. I think that, and I think that was your statement.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Is that in the preceding case we had a discussion about business records? Would that always be the case? For instance, would an accused have the possibility of having records of extended stays that were not the kind of stays of the military, but vacations or business trips? So wouldn't an accused benefit from a shorter time period, even in the domestic situation, because that would provide a greater opportunity for the accused to rebut the allegation of because the accused may be able to show, I wasn't there.
Right. I think that everyone benefits from the narrowest charging period possible in all of these cases. The state benefits because, at trial, if there's an extended charging period, then credibility issues come to mind immediately.
Which they always do.
Always do. But, certainly the defense can benefit then from a narrower charging period where they may be able to fashion some sort of alibi for a portion of the period at least.
Heard you make that statement, I thought, well, it has the benefit of simplicity, but I'm not quite sure it always applies.
Right. I understand that just because the person lives with doesn't mean there might be other circumstances that would take the defendant away for an extended period of time, and that could be demonstrated somehow.
Yes.
And just because the defendant has an alibi for a period of the charging, ultimately the defense is still going to be a credibility defense because they don't have an alibi for all of the time that's charged. And it's just a difficult fact of these cases that, children cannot recall the details of when the assaults occurred. And so we permit, understandably, broader charging periods. And so even in those cases that have relatively short charging periods of weeks or a month or two, it's difficult to, with a live-in offender, to see how they would present anything other than a credibility defense.
Don't you think an alibi defense in this context with these kinds of charges, it doesn't have the same, it strikes me that it's a rare day that an alibi defense will actually be the winner for the defendant. Because I could see a group of facts under which, I'm just thinking back to repeated acts of sexual assault trials that I had as a judge. You know, it'd be, well, after my mom left for work, I could hear the shower turn off, and then I knew that he was going to come into my room. And, it'd be that sort of testimony that the jury might find very compelling, right?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And that's what held the day. And it boiled down to, did you or didn't you? But let's just say in those instances, the defendant said, well, you know what, I wasn't there this week in June of 2008. Then it strikes me that the victim would probably say, okay, well, if you weren't there, that's not when it happened, but it sure seemed like every day to me. And so it wasn't that week, but it was every other week surrounding that.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So while you might have an alibi for a portion of time, when you have a live-in, that becomes a lot more difficult to show that an alibi is going to be a valid defense. The defense often boils down to, if not always, who does a jury believe? And when you're going that far, often the best defense for the defendant, because they're struggling between how do you sort of, make a victim look not credible without looking like you're being too tough on a victim. That's the biggest dilemma, I think, for the defense a lot of times. But I don't see how, we keep talking about alibi, but I don't see how in a live-in kind of situation that's really going to be often the defense that holds the day, unless it's so specific that it's a specific time period on a specific day when this specifically happens, and then they say they had an alibi, then the victim would say, okay, well, I guess it wasn't that day, and you can amend the pleadings, right?
Yeah, I agree with that. And the reason that we're talking so much here about alibi is because, that's the kind of offense, that's the kind of defense that a defendant could fashion with a more narrow charging period. But in these cases, that defense is not available.
Well, suppose the charging period is 4 or 5 years. I've forgotten exactly what it was here, but it was a long
6 years,
period,
yeah.
6 years. And can show that 3 of those years he was in Iraq. What does that do to the state?
The state in that situation would hopefully charge only the period that the defendant was here. If it doesn't, then that's a due process violation. And
so alibi is important, and that the narrower the time frame, then that gives the defendant notice as to what time period he has to account for his whereabouts, right? And in RAR, that's exactly what the state did. The defendant showed that was not a possible date, and so the state just amended the complaint, right?
Right.
So what's the procedure here? The state broadens it to 10, 12, 15 years. The defendant has an alibi for 4 or 5 of the years, so the state then amends the complaint. State's 20 less 5 or 10 versus less 5, and we go on from there. So alibi is important. And the narrower the time frame, the better the defendant can defend against that time.
Although, frankly, under that group of facts, if I'm the defense lawyer, I'd rather not bring that up ahead of time and give you the opportunity to conform the complaint to that evidence, because I'd want that evidence to come in to show this victim isn't credible. I'd want to show, look, I know you say this happened, but I was in Iraq for 3 years.
Yeah,
you wouldn't want that to be a pre-trial determination. I wouldn't want that as a defense lawyer. So it may be important, but that actually cuts against the defendant. So I'm back to where I was before.
Yeah, it would be in the state's interest in that case to charge a more narrow charging period that reflects the fact that he was in Iraq during that time.
Does the complaint or information get amended to fit the evidence?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Criminal case as in a civil case?
Right.
Okay. One of your key arguments is continuous acts, and it states as well, we're really charging 26 acts, right? And the defendant says, where did you get 26 from? Well, the complaint on page 129, amended criminal complaint, this is your appendix, Mr. Whitwer?
Yes.
Is that the last complaint? And that's the complaint that we went on. It says, and I'm not familiar enough with repeated sexual assault complaints because I haven't ever focused on that, although we've obviously had repeated sexual assault complaints. It says, the above-named defendant between 2000 and 2005 in Peshtigo did commit 3 or more violations involving the same child who was not yet 16. So the complaint is 3 or more violations with the same child over 5 years. The probable cause part of the complaint does talk about different acts of the defendant. But how does the defendant know what he's being charged with when the complaint says 3 or more violations?
How does he
know it's 26 and that they're A and B and C and D and they're all different, or many of them are different, right?
I think that he and his attorney would go through and use a common sense approach to understand what is being alleged in the complaint. We don't require complaints to be hyper-technically, they don't need to, they need to allege the elements of the offense, and they need to provide sufficient factual allegations to
assume
support
three
them.
Or more is because that's what the statute
says. That's what the statute says.
But I don't see what's so common sense that it's 26.
Isn't your answer sub 2? I mean, you can't.
Sub 2.
The state wouldn't be able to, since there are 26, the state wouldn't be able to say 26 divided by 3. I'm going to charge 8 counts. It's 3 or more. So he's not charged with 8 counts of 3 or more. He's charged with 1 count of 3 or more. It just happens to be 26, and the jury need not even decide which 3 it's basing its 3 or more on under sub 2. Which was my first question to you. How could we decide for the defense without essentially finding sub 2 to be unconstitutional?
I think that the it does charge one offense. It charges one offense, and that offense needs to be demonstrated by proving three or more acts of child sexual assault, qualifying acts under 948.02 sub 1 and sub 2. And in this complaint alleges both the sections dealing with intercourse and with sexual contact. And the attorney for the defendant going over that complaint, assessing what is actually being alleged, would go through and say, okay, what constitutes intercourse and what constitutes contact here in the complaint? And in doing so, they would find that the 20 allegations of having the victim take off her clothes and then putting her on his shoulders naked to be weighed would constitute sexual contact under the definition of the statutes. But I don't think that the outcome in this case necessarily hinges on whether it's 26 or it's 5 or it's 6. I think that the analysis should not be focused primarily on the math of the case, but on the availability, the actual availability of another defense, particularly in the post-conviction setting, and on an application of all of the Fawcett factors in this instance, taking into account that this is a charge under 948.025, the repeated child sexual assault statute, which the legislature has.
So you think that case, I know you wouldn't support this, but it's possible under the facts of the case and on pre versus post conviction that you could reach a different result here and in Kampanen.
I think that the analysis would be different. Yeah, or it should be different because it's pre and post.
Okay, that's what I'm asking. You haven't spent any time on the other two issues. I know time flies when you're having fun. So would you just spend literally a minute on the other acts? Because the Court of Appeals went to that. Now, the Circuit Court went to the other issue. In both the Circuit Court and Court of Appeals, you lost.
That's correct, on different grounds, yeah.
On different grounds. That's highly unusual.
It was highly unusual. It was a hat trick, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't a hat trick. It's unusual for the state to lose in both courts, trial and appellate, and on different grounds. So just give us your
I concede that point.
Other act. Okay, I figured you would.
It you is. Better watch out.
Yep.
Hat trick.
Let us straight.
Let us straight. Thank you. Thanks for the tip. Other acts evidence, the Circuit Court, as I argued in my brief, and I am in a position where I need to stand on my briefs here, but briefly, the Court of Appeals in this case, I believe, substituted its own judgment for the judgment of the Circuit Court because there were permissible purposes for which it was offered, modus operandi, as well, I argued, motive. I think it could also be admitted for credibility, given that that the similarity between the charges where another immediate family member comes forward with very similar allegations would lend credibility to the allegations of the defendant. So I believe that it's for at least those three permissible purposes. And then it's relevant because There are many similarities, despite the differences in age of the the defendant at the time, and the length of time. There's enough similarities, particularly applying the greater latitude rule, in order for it to be admitted. And then, in this case, the third factor, undue prejudice or unfair prejudice, it was not, the probative value was not substantially outweighed by the risk of unfair prejudice, in part because there was a two clear limiting instructions offered to the jury, first before the testimony was offered, and second before it was given to the jury. So.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for the defendant, Mr. Powell, Craig S. Powell.
Well, thank you, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. My name is Craig Powell, and I represent Joel Hurley in this matter. And I don't mean to be presumptuous, but I presume this Court's going to deliver the final hat trick to the State, in this case, the real hat trick. And I say that because this
don't
is
don't be led astray, counsel.
I say that because this case is a frightening one in this sense. Joel Hurley, at the age of 37, is contacted by the police. His ex-stepdaughter, former stepdaughter, has come forward in 2010 and made allegations to her mother that he inappropriately touched her years ago. And her mother has a brother who's a police officer. She contacts him. The investigation begins. That investigation includes, among other things, recorded phone calls with Mr. Hurley where he explicitly denies anything like this occurred. Eventually, a criminal complaint issues, charging him with repeated acts of sexual assault. And that complaint is at the core of why we're sitting here today, a complaint that tells Mr. Hurley, upon his notice, that on and between 2000 and 2005, on approximately five occasions, he placed his hand on his ex-stepdaughter's vagina. She's identified in this case as MCN. That's who I'm referring to when I use those initials going forward. The complaint itself provides no additional narrowing information at all to provide Mr. Hurley with any idea when within that time period, 2,192 days, when those things may have occurred. That's on top of the fact that this information comes forward in 2010, when the time period allegedly stopped in 2005. Although it could have stopped in 2000, because again, there is no way to limit when it occurred. By the complaint and MCM's inability to narrow it, all these events could have occurred in 2000, 10 years prior. So this is what Mr. Hurley is faced with in proceeding to trial. And we have a situation where, as counsel for the state has noted, this is not pretrial, so we have a bigger record to look at. We have a preliminary hearing where MCN testified and confirmed that she is wholly unable to narrow this period any further, not by grade, not by season, not by relation to any other event in her life. It is, here's what she got, 6 years. On top of that, you've got allegations of approximately five instances of a fairly generic description of an event. Climbing into bed with me, putting his hand down my pajamas on my vagina. There's no distinction between different actions, which is unlike campaigning, I would say, where there's more specific details of each assault, and they differ. There is basically a complete inability to provide any real detail to what happened or narrow the time period. And then you have the trial. And this is where it gets scary for a lot of people who I've talked about this case with. And any observer of the criminal justice system, and maybe people here in this courtroom will understand what I say. Here's the evidence in the case. MCN testifies to those events with her limited ability to recall. Many, many, many of her answers at trial, including on cross-examination, are, I don't remember, I don't recall. Making cross-examination, of course, very difficult of a witness who doesn't remember much of anything except what's most important, the allegations and the fact that something happened, but not when or really how or anything like that. Then the state puts on an expert witness, Susan Lockwood, to tell the jury that it's okay, it's normal that children don't remember details. It's normal that children don't come forward till later. That's normal. purpose of which, of course, is to tell the jury, don't hold that against the witness. Then you have the other acts witness, Mr. Hurley's sister, who's permitted to testify that when she was a child, and Mr. Hurley was a child, 25 years to 27 years before this trial date, that they had sexual contact between them when they were kids. That's permitted. And Mr. Hurley takes the stand and testifies in his own defense and denies it that anything happened, denies it. And he was sentenced to 25 years in prison on that record. That's what's scary about this case.
Did he deny?
Aren't there really more, though? You want to limit it to the times when he put his fingers in her vagina. But there were 20 times that she said on a very regular basis when she came home from school, she took off her clothes at his request while he took them off, put her naked on his shoulders, carried her into the bathroom on his shoulders, and then weighed her. And those are also alleged in the complaint as instances of sexual assault. And I know in your brief you want to limit to five, because if you've got a number of years and you say five events occurred, somehow it seems you should be able to particularize them more than if you have 26 events, which is what is alleged in the complaint. How is it, again, that you think there was no sexual contact when a naked child was placed on Mr. Hurley's shoulders and then given a horseyback ride into the bathroom to be weighed?
That's not in the complaint, Your Honor, that she was given a horseyback ride.
He was placed on his shoulders.
The complaint doesn't say how respectfully, Your Honor. It just says, in addition to that, it says at the end that he went no further than placing her on the scale. So if we're talking about reasonable inferences from what's in the complaint, the fact that he went no further than that suggests to me that's not a sexual assault. Another point you raised, Your Honor, is...
It says she stated, I'm reading from the complaint, page 2, she stated that after getting home from school, the defendant would have her take her clothing off and would put her on his shoulders to take her to the bathroom. Okay, stop with that sentence. Why isn't that sexual contact between Hurley and this child?
There's no allegation that any part of his body is in contact with an intimate part of her body as the statute requires.
Well, if he placed her on his shoulders, he could sit her on one shoulder with her bare bottom on the shoulder, or he could put her legs on either side of her neck with her bare bottom touching both sides of his neck. I don't know how he can place her on her shoulders when she's naked without having contact.
Well, those are two ways. He also perhaps sling her over his shoulder this way, but the court's question ignores the significant part of what is sexual assault, which includes an intent to sexually gratify Mr. Hurley.
I understand all of that.
And so that's why the sentence that follows.
Sentence that follows where?
MCN stated that during these encounters, the defendant would not go any further than have her naked on his shoulders and weigh her, mm-hmm. I think is what supports an inference that that is not an allegation of sexual assault. And if we look forward into the record, the trial record, the state did not make that argument. The state argued to the jury that the sexual assault that occurred here was the touching of the vagina with his hand in bed. So I think...
You're telling me that the state did not argue that he's placing her naked on the shoulder was sexual assault? I understand the state may have focused more on the other argument, but are you really telling me the state did not make that argument at trial?
That's my recollection.
None of these 20 contacts had anything to do with the state's case at trial?
My recollection of the record, Your Honor, yes.
Is there a motion then made to dismiss or anything at the conclusion of the case based on that?
There may have been a pro forma motion to dismiss at the close of the state's case. I don't recall, frankly, Your Honor.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you.
Another issue I want to touch on, however, Your Honor, raised regarding the 20 assaults versus 5 or 6 and the difference there is we're talking about two distinct sets of assaults as well. So we're talking about the failure of the child to be able to identify specific acts or times. Those are two separate, I would say, classes of assault if the court's inclined to say, yes, there are 26. And in each instance, the child is not able to specify as to when any of those things occurred.
Well, you know, when what occurs is so similar. You got a little girl who's 6 years old that comes home and all her clothes are taken off and she gets put on somebody's shoulders and taken into the bathroom to be weighed. Well, there's no injury to the child that her mom would notice. Her bottom isn't sore. Nothing like that would show up from what was going on here. And if you're just, you may think it's odd as a child that your clothes are taken off and you're then taken into the bathroom to be weighed. But I'm not sure why you think she should be able to define one day that occurred from another day that occurred. They're so similar. What would be defining that the complaint should have said in a way that would have described them differently?
I'm not saying it would have to even be as specific as a day. It's not even as specific as a grade or a season or any identification whatsoever.
That's right.
And we have cases, Fawcett, RAR, all these cases that talk about periods of months that have been said, that's okay, because we give flexible.
Well, we have McGuire, which is 36 years.
But that's a different issue. That's the statute of
limitations. He was out of the state for a period
That we're talking about the charging period of when the assaults occur, not how long you wait to charge it. But we've got these cases where months have been deemed to be okay, and that's largely because we give flexible notice requirements in child sexual assault cases for that reason. But there's a line in Fawcett that is critical, and I don't want to say it's been overlooked, but it is, frankly, and that is, no matter how abhorrent the allegations may be, a defendant's due process and Sixth Amendment rights to fair notice of the charges and fair opportunity to defend may not be ignored or trivialized. So, yes, the legislature has taken note of the difficulties in these kinds of cases. Yes, our case law has given latitude to the state in admitting certain evidence and given flexibility and notice requirements. But that doesn't do away with base rights, fundamental rights.
But, Counselor, what I hear you saying is if the child waits long enough to report it, and now we hear the legislature has extended that to age 45, but here we're just looking at a period of years. If the child waits long enough to report it, then under your argument, the defendant's due process rights are always violated.
Not always. Because McGuire and the statute of limitations deals with the potential for a delay in prosecution. That's one factor under Fawcett, the length of time between the end of the allegations and when the charge is brought. Another factor, and a critical one in most cases, and especially in this case, the factor I'm talking about in this case that's most critical is the length of time over which the assaults span. In this case, 6 years.
Counsel, 6 years. Can I follow up a little bit on what Justice Rogenczak was questioning you on made me want to go to the jury instructions. And while the amended complaint is fairly broad in nature, and there are the 26 potential things that could have comprised either contact or intercourse, the jury instruction is limited to intercourse, which in the amended complaint is limited to 5 occasions. So how would you have had those 5 occasions further limited? This wasn't a case, I mean, after having looked at that, I now realize that it really wasn't a case where they could have picked any 3 or more of 26. They picked 3 or more of 5. And, you know, that involved the vaginal penetration. So how would you have had the state further define that in the complaint, given the facts that are alleged?
Well, how I would have done it, I mean, they're limited by the information they have and what their witness can do, of course. But the real question is what's okay and what's sufficient from a notice perspective. And, I mean, RAR may be instructive, at least at the time where you've got summer of 82, summer of 83, 3-month periods, a little bit longer periods than Fawcett, I believe, maybe 4.5 months, if my memory is correct, by grade, something to narrow it down even a little bit. There's nothing. And if she could have narrowed it down to a grade, say second grade or third grade or a year, maybe that wouldn't be good enough. I don't know. I know what we have is zero narrowing at all. And that gets to, I think, the crux of what this case and these issues are about, and I believe it's something that Justice Rogenczak may have asked very early on in the last case of Justice Crooks, that this is really a question of reasonableness. And is this really a test or just a framework to try and answer that question? And Fawcett provides the framework. And as we've sat now through the companion case and the state's presentation here and read the briefs, no one's really asking for anything different. The reasonableness inquiry relative to this claim goes back to Cruikshank in 1875, and that's where we are. And the Fawcett factors come from the Morris case in New York, all with an idea to figure out, help circuit courts face with these questions, help them decide what in a given case is reasonable. And in that case, I think it's somewhat analogous maybe to Fourth Amendment cases, where you're looking at what's a reasonable search, and there are certain factors you look at. But at the end of the day, and Justice Abramson used the term totality of the circumstances, but that seems to be where we're at. And these kinds of cases also evoke to me one of the more famous quips in American jurisprudence, which is Potter Stewart talking about obscenity when he says, I know when I see it. These factors can guide courts, give them things to look at and consider when you see a charging conference, or excuse me, a charging period, and say, you know, how does someone prepare a defense to something like that? How do you prepare a defense to an accusation that on 3 or 4 or 5 instances over a 6-year period you committed this terrible act? How does one defend themselves?
Yeah, I mean, this is when she alleges he would come into her bedroom at night, put his hands in her pajama bottoms, and proceed accordingly, and then try to get her to also touch him. How would you further define that? I mean, it's a nighttime routine. I mean, how would you have the state further define that? How does that not end up just being a credibility? He did this to me. I didn't do that to her. I mean, how would he otherwise defend against that? What would the defense to that be? Because that's what the jury was instructed to decide whether he did or not.
One of the fundamental problems with the state's argument is, how do you explain what defenses you lost out because you don't know what the period is? It's almost impossible to do. But generally speaking...
Is he saying he never tucked her in, not once, in no, 6 years?
Generally speaking, you look at perhaps there's an elemental defense. For example, it requires, let's say the girl at this age may have had some sort of medical issue, like urinary tract infection or something. And Mr. Hurley, in the course of applying medication for that or ointment for that, that's what he was doing. And the girl years later has a memory and misinterprets that that happened.
Well, then his defense isn't that he didn't touch her there. The defense would be, yeah, I did this, but it was medically necessary. I think as a parent, especially a male parent, when the mother presumably is also there, you might have the mom do that, but maybe not. And so then that should be something that might click in his mind. Well,
but
that's a different defense than this never happened. You can't have that both ways.
Well, I took the court's question to be, what kind of defenses could he bring other than I didn't do it? And that is one. And that the fact that the court would say, well, I think he would remember that, goes to the very issue we're talking about, where if you're looking at 10 years removed from that happening, a defendant may have no memory of that, may have no memory that this child had this medical issue 10 years ago in a specific time frame to even think to look for records.
Well, one of the you mentioned the various commonalities between the prior case and this. You mentioned one of them. Another one is the phrase that keeps popping up because it's so often the crux of these kinds of cases, which is credibility determination. And it seems to me, you asked rhetorically a few minutes ago, well, how can a defendant ever defend himself with a time period this long? And I guess the answer is it's going to come down to a credibility determination to be made by the jury. And is your argument before us today, are you asking us to substitute our judgment for that of the trial court?
No. Some things are not meant for juries, and that's the purpose of the Constitution and due process. Courts decide what is a due process issue, what are constitutional issues and rights, what are the scopes of those rights. The due process rights, and this is how you have to look at this particular issue, I believe, is that you have to look at a charging document from the perspective of an innocent person. And does the charge allow an innocent person to defend himself? Because when someone is charged, they are, of course, presumed innocent, and there's a very real possibility they are innocent.
Of course, counsel.
Correct. So we're not asking this court to say, okay, so the jury made a finding here. They weighed the credibility of the witnesses. They even got to hear from Mr. Hurley, which is oftentimes not something juries get to hear.
True.
And they sided with the witness. So that's our system, and so it goes. But Mr. Hurley's testimony in the trial itself proceeded in a way that he, because of the nature of the charging period, he was not able to adequately prepare a defense. You don't know what you've lost when you don't know what you're looking for.
I know you said that in response to Justice Ziegler's question in regard to, and then that's where we got into the discussion of a medical necessity. But I don't see, what are you asking us to do here? If you could write the holding, you maybe heard me ask that question one other time. If you could write the holding here, what would it be?
Well, I would first reconfirm what I mentioned before, the line from Foss said about these rights cannot be ignored or trivialized, and affirm the Court of Appeals decision in this case.
The rule, I know you're concerned about this case, as you, obviously, we are too, but we have the extra burden, the extra duty of looking down the road for future cases. What is the rule that you would like to this court to interpret or apply or write as the holding of this case? What rule emerges from this case that will be applicable to all other similar cases?
Well, I view it as not changing. And it comes through Fawcett, and Your Honor has noted this throughout the day, that this is a framework, as I've said, not necessarily a test. Factors courts can consider all these factors or any other factor they may deem relevant to the inquiry of whether this charge is reasonably defined.
How does that not put us in the position then, and I'm not going to say this is going to rule the day, because this court, like most, like many courts, has a pattern of choosing to correct error or not, but we are not supposed to be an error-correcting court. We are supposed to be a law-developing court. How is that not error correction?
Well, I think in my brief I noted I thought that's what the state is actually seeking here, because there is really no material change to the test that they've sought.
You're right.
And that's come through both the state's argument in Campaignan, where they explicitly said we're not even seeking a different test for a single act case versus a repeated acts case.
My question had its basis in the Chief Justice's earlier observation that it is not the usual posture of that this case presents itself in. So, yes, your point is well taken.
So you would... You would, if I understand your argument, you just would adopt the per curiam opinion of the Court of Appeals. You think they got it right. Anything you'd change in the Court of Appeals?
In the Court of Appeals' opinion in this case?
Yeah. Isn't this Hurley? You won it.
I did. And
you won it in 31 page, 32 page, 24 pages,
right.
Sorry. It's a long opinion for the Court of Appeals, especially a per curiam.
I might publish it. Other than that, Your Honor, I
think... Well, we can publish it, because we can say we adopted in whole. Is that what you want?
Seeing that opinion, I think it covers all the grounds of Fawcett. It applies the seven factors that exist. It applied them in a way that I think was reasonable. It came to what, of course, I believe to be the right conclusion, and certainly a reasonable one, and I think it's correct. I'm not here seeking a change in Fawcett or the law, and I frankly don't think the state is.
Can I ask a question? There's been a lot of reference to credibility determinations.
Yes.
If let's just take a hypothetical with the same facts. When so many allegations have been made, is there any other alternative than to believe that the alleged victim is not telling the truth?
I'm afraid I don't understand the court's question. I don't understand the question, Your Honor. There's always an alternative, I suppose, but I don't understand the question.
Aren't we basically saying that the victim is lying about all of these things? If a defendant under circumstances like this is innocent, isn't the victim lying? Alleged victim lying?
That's necessarily true. Yes.
How? You talked about an expert witness testifying for the government. Are there any expert witnesses who talk about widespread lying by alleged victims of child sexual assault? I mean, how often do you see actual lying in your experience?
Well, I think that's an impossible thing to quantify. I mean, I can say that I've seen experts like Ms. Lockwood, who testified in this case on cross-examination, who will admit that, yes, they have been involved in interviews with young witnesses who have admitted to making up the allegations that have lied. That does happen. But, of course, every case is different. Just as it is an awful and terrible thing that there are people who commit crimes against children in this world and people can't imagine that actually happens, it also happens that people make false allegations against others for a variety of reasons. That also happens. And that may be hard to believe, and juries especially may find it hard to believe, but it does in fact occur. And due process exists to make it, frankly, difficult for the state to prevail in criminal cases, because that's the protection that you afford the citizens of this country when they're accused and their liberty is put at stake. You put in process and barriers and make it challenging and difficult to convict someone so that there can be some measure of satisfaction that the person who's been put away, in this case for 25 years, is actually guilty of what he's been convicted of. That's what due process is about, and it's failed in this case by the way the state has brought the charge.
What I heard from Justice Process's question, which may not be what was intended or how you interpreted it, is suppose she had said that he carried her on his shoulders three times. Does that make her more or less credible than if she says 20 times or once a week or whatever it says? That, I think, was the, and just for the record, Justice Prosser is nodding his head yes. So that if somebody says, hey, you did it 20 times, 30 times, you know, every hour, on the hour, doesn't it make her more credible than if she said, well, it only happened three times, five times, or even seven times? I think that's the tenor of
You can't assign likelihood of credibility to a particular number of allegations that are made, just as you can't ascribe a bright-line rule to what's an unreasonable charging theory.
No, but if she says 20 times, it means she's more apt to remember it, even if she's less than 13 years of age. So that a repeat offense is more likely to be remembered and is more likely to cover a 5 or 6 year period than a short term. I mean, I think that was the tenor of...
Although he wasn't convicted of carrying her on his shoulders. It was...
What was he convicted
of? Vaginal intercourse, and that was the alleged five times, not the 26.
The jury was instructed on intercourse, which was MCN's testimony of at least three and maybe five times of him putting his fingers in her vagina. That was what.
That was what the
and
instruction
then getting her
was.
To touch him or at least try.
That would not have been an intercourse instruction, but.
Right, but right. That was part of that scenario, according to.
Was there a contact instruction?
No, there was not. That's what I've been trying to find here, which I. Was not aware of, because the initial instruction just goes to a violation of 948.021 without a subsection which includes contact as well as intercourse.
That's right.
But then if you look further in the instructions, elements of the crime the state must prove, it is limited just to 948.021B. And the instruction is for intercourse. It is not for sexual contact.
So right.
I certainly will be asking you something about that when you have a chance to come back and help us some more.
What I was really trying to get at is that alibis, it seems to me, are incredibly valuable when you've got maybe mistaken eyewitness identification in a robbery or a fight or something like that. Here, there can't be any mistake when you accuse your stepfather of multiple sexual offenses. I mean, you can't mistake your stepfather, I don't think. So when those accusations are made, they either are basically true or basically false, aren't they?
Not necessarily. As I pointed out with the hypothetical to Justice Ziegler before, if there was a medical condition that required some attention and there had been some contact between a father and daughter or father and stepdaughter, and, you know, years later, when an allegation is made, the child may remember it a way that it didn't actually occur. And so it's not that it didn't happen at all. It's that it didn't happen the way that she is recalling the way it happened. So it's not an absolute that it didn't happen at all or it happened. It could have happened in a way that's not a crime. I see the red light is on.
Sum up quickly, please.
I just ask the court to uphold the Court of Appeals' decision in this case in its entirety. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Whitwer.
Counsel, can you briefly address for me the third issue and why you don't lose on that one?
We don't lose on the third issue because, unlike in the Weiss case, and I think this is covered in my brief, unlike in the Weiss case, the prosecutor in this case did not ask the jury to draw an inference that the prosecutor knew to be false based on facts outside of the record. What happened in Weiss was that the prosecutor knew that the defendant had previously denied the allegations to police. And then when the prosecutor in closing argument came up, she said he denied them on the stand here, and this is the first time that he's ever denied them. That was false. Asked the jury to draw an inference that was false. In this case, he didn't ask the jury to draw any inference that was false because there was no the testimony is that he was commenting on the defendant's testimony. The defendant says, he doesn't make a strong denial. He just says, I don't recall. I don't recall it happening. That was the testimony that was elicited from the defense counsel. And the prosecutor says, well, that's different than whether it happened or not. Those remarks are completely confined to the reasonable inferences that can be drawn from that testimony. They don't comment on anything that was said outside of the record. And, in fact, the one denial that did happen in this case, which, again, wasn't commented on by the prosecutor or didn't ask to draw any sort of inference about it, whether it was made or not, was not to police, but it was to the accuser herself on the phone. And so he never made a statement to police.
So the circuit court erred.
Absolutely. Yeah. I believe, yeah, of the issues presented in this case, that's probably the least close, I think.
What law development is this, or is this case before us only on error correction on behalf of?
Well, I think that given the passage of time since Fawcett was issued, that there have been significant changes in the legal landscape. And we have a lot of cases from other jurisdictions that, in fact, the majority view from other jurisdictions is rather than applying a reasonableness test, they now look simply to whether another defense was available. Now, there isn't a single case that I'm aware of in Wisconsin that applying the Fawcett factors, which I would agree should be a totality of the circumstances test, that considers the availability of other defenses. And I think that's critical to whether, in fact, the defendant was denied the right to prepare a defense. That's the due process violation that's alleged. And I think it needs to also reflect the fact that we now have a statute. The legislature has authorized charging three or more assaults as a single offense, and that the purpose of that statute is to facilitate prosecution of child sex offenses. That should be taken into account when evaluating these particular charges. And I also think that in looking at factors 5 and 6 of the Fawcett test, which have to do with the delay in reporting, that the fact that the legislature has now increased the statute of limitations to 40, to, where the victim can report up to 45 years old, here in these cases, that factor should not be taken, should not be weighed nearly as heavily given those developments.
Also, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about...
If I may just follow up. So your understanding, the summation mm-hmm. of your opinion, it's not because there may be a conflict between RAR and Fawcett, but rather, given the passage of time, the legal landscape may have changed.
I apologize for not making clear. I believe that RAR needs to be overturned as well. I relied on the state's brief in Kempinen to make that point. I knew that the Assistant Attorney General preparing that brief was going to make those arguments, and so I didn't use the 11,000 words that I had to make my arguments on that. So,
I would like you to address whether, as we review whether the complaint is sufficient, we look at 5 counts, as the jury instruction seems to focus on, or do we look at 26 counts? Your briefs are very different. Defense counsel said there were not 26. There were only 5. Now, if you look at what was tried, and I have to go back and read sections of the transcript again from the trial, but clearly the jury instructions allege a violation of 948.021 without a subparagraph, which includes sexual intercourse and sexual contact. But then when you go into the elements of the crime the state must prove, it's very limited, and it is only sexual intercourse, and it is only 1B. So there seemed to be some credibility to counsel's assertion that what was really being proceeded on here was just 5 counts, not 26 counts. Can you address that?
Yes, I'd be happy to. The prosecutor in this case made a strategic decision that he would go to the jury on only the 5 intercourse counts, and so those were the counts that were instructed to the jury. There was testimony provided supporting the allegations at trial. In fact, somewhat more detailed testimony from the victim, saying that the defendant would put her she would take her clothes off, and then he would put her naked on his shoulders with her legs on either side of his neck, which certainly supports the inference from that is already in the complaint. But I guess my larger point here is that when we're looking at notice, we're looking at the complaint.
Correct. Correct.
And so while the prosecutor made a strategic decision to go to the jury on only the intercourse counts for whatever reason, we need to take a look at what facts are actually, what reasonable inferences can be drawn from the complaint. What would the defendant reasonably know that he's being need to defend against?
But this is post-conviction. And you started out your argument, if I understood it, that pre-conviction and post-conviction are different, and in post-conviction you can look at the whole thing.
I do believe so, and I recognize the conceptual difficulty here, but I think that when we're taking a look at an allegation of post-conviction, you're looking at it under plain error, and is the defendant denied the right to present a defense under these circumstances? He presented
looking
a vigorous credibility defense.
We're looking on a plain error because counsel did not make an objection pre-trial or during trial.
Correct.
So the plain error test is only to overcome the forfeiture or waiver, and let's not go into that, but it wasn't done. And the general rule is, but if it's plain error, the court can look at it. Right?
Right.
So the plain error doesn't have anything to do except to overcome the lack of an objection here. It doesn't change the notice. And in 948.025 sub A, the three violations could either be intercourse or contact.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So a statement made here earlier that it was only it could only be intercourse is not right. So they could have charged and could have proven under 1A.
They did charge.
You can charge either, but when you go to trial, it's often narrowed to what the state intends to have the jury consider for purposes of the three.
I think you're getting help from the bench, counsel.
It's never happened in this room before.
But you always have to worry whether it's correct help. Okay, so.
My point was that the charging document alleges, is broad enough to allege contact or intercourse, but the prosecutor made a strategic decision just to go to the jury on intercourse, and that was what was instructed to the jury.
Thank you.
You know, one question that I have when Chief Justice Abrahams, and one thing that I would like to ask is, with discretionary decisions, reviewing courts owe the trial court deference. Do the reviewing courts here, the Court of Appeals, and do we owe any discretion, deference to the circuit court's exercise of its judgment in this matter?
No, it's a legal question.
Solely a question of law.
Solely a question of law.
Okay.
So in your view, it doesn't matter what was taken to the jury. Just as a complaint alleged first-degree homicide, and for whatever reason, after the trial, the prosecutor decided to go to the jury on a lesser included, you still evaluate whether the complaint gave proper notice as a complaint.
Right. I think that's the case because, again, the claim is that he was denied the right to prepare a defense, and so that, that's sometime before trial that right is denied. Now, the reason I say that we should take a look at what's actually the defense that's actually made at trial is that you should be able to take into account at this stage, at this late date, what defenses were actually made in order to determine whether he had something else available. But again, the inquiry should also be made pretrial because any reasonableness test, I believe, needs to take into account the availability of other defenses under the circumstances. So
that's how you mesh your argument.
Yes.
Okay. Counsel.
Chief.
Justice Bradley.
In this case, the circuit court determined that the prosecution made an improper remark during closing argument. What deference, if any, do we owe to that determination of the circuit court? The circuit court, as I understood, ordered a new trial after having gone through all of this, thought that a new trial was needed because the prosecutor sought to draw the jury to an unfair inference. That's a pretty bold move for a circuit court.
Yeah.
What deference do we owe to that determination of the circuit court?
Given the posture of the case, we owe no deference to it because it wasn't a timely raised objection. It was raised post-conviction, and the court decided it on plain error grounds, said that the prosecutor's remark constituted plain error.
Okay. Thank
you. Your position that the circuit court essentially misperceived what the prosecutor's remark was in relationship to the testimony given.
That's correct.
Thank you very much, counsel. I want to thank counsel for the defendant and for the state, Attorney Whitwer and Attorney Powell, for their argument in Hurley, pointing out the similarities and differences with the earlier case. And so we close the argument in State v. Hurley, 13-8-P-558-CR. The students may remain, and Justice Bradley will come out and talk with you all. And the court will reconvene at 1:30 for its third case today.